Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, a shocking loss has happened with the untimely death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, the soul of the High Court's conservative wing and an ardent foe of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, Mark, Scalia's passing leaves the court with an even split along ideological lines, for conservatives, for liberals, at a time when some very important health-related matters are coming before the High Court. These cases involve Texas abortion laws, the mandate requiring employers' health plans to provide birth control to employees, certainly an aspect of the law that has drawn a lot of ire from the religiously-based entities.
And it's possible the decision on these important health-related matters could be put on hold until a ninth justice is approved for the vacancy. That in itself is a big emerging story. While President Obama is saying he will announce candidate for the position, many political opponents are demanding that the decision be left until the new president has been elected. And they also vow to block approval of any potential candidate put forth by the president. It will certainly be an interesting story to watch unfold.
And it will, and this is turning out to be a most interesting year. And in the meantime, health reform is moving forward in many meaningful ways. Coverage for about 13 million Americans has been secured under the Affordable Care Act, according to the most recent numbers. And I think we can say innovation in the healthcare space is reaching a fevered pitch, wouldn't you say?
I think you're right. And while there are thousands of health tech startups springing up around the country and around the world, over half of them are predicted to fail. Our guest today is overseeing a new kind of health innovation model, recently lauded by the Harvard Business School as one to watch.
Our guest today, Joe Randolph, president and CEO of the Innovation Institute, a Southern California-based innovation lab and venture operation that is offering not-for-profit health organizations a chance to facilitate research and development of their innovations aimed at improving healthcare delivery in this country. We're looking forward to hearing about their approach.
Laurie Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, stops by. She's always looking to uncover misstatements, spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter at chcradio, because we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Joe Randolph of the Innovation Institute in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The sleuths of epidemiology are on the case. Researchers analyzing the recent outbreak and rapid spread of the Zika virus are studying its genetic components to try and understand why a virus that's been around for almost 70 years and has always been considered a mild cousin of its other mosquito-borne pathogens like malaria and dengue fever, why there's now real concern for connection to major birth defects. Thousands of babies born to women in Brazil, where the outbreak has been most prevalent, have been born with serious birth defects, including microcephaly, a smaller-sized head and brain. And while World Health officials are cautious about laying all the blame for those defects on Zika alone, they do warn it poses a serious threat to women who are pregnant or trying to get pregnant and traveling to South and Central America, as well as the Caribbean. Some physicians in the region have raised questions of whether pesticides sprayed directly into the region's drinking water may be a culprit in the rash of birth defects. Meanwhile, thousands of pregnant women in Colombia who were exposed to the virus are being watched. It's too soon to tell if the Zika virus is leading to similar birth defects in that country as well. Meanwhile, with a vaccine at least 18 months away, the World Health Organization is considering a number of other methods to combat the spread of Zika, including genetically modified mosquitoes and bacteria that can thwart the development of mosquito larvae. Meanwhile, U.S. health officials are gearing up for warmer months, when that type of mosquito that carries the Zika virus will be found along Gulf Coast states predominantly. More cases of Legionnaire's disease have been reported in Flint, Michigan, where the tainted drinking water case continues to unfold. Families in the region are being supplied with daily allotments of bottled water, and some homes have been outfitted with special filters, which removes most of the harmful toxins for bathing and drinking. Investigation into the crisis and who is responsible continues. Russia is claiming the U.S. is responsible for airstrikes on four hospitals in war-torn Syria, normally off-limits in war zones. The airstrikes appear to be intended direct hits on the medical facilities, including a children's and maternity hospital and one run by Doctors Without Borders. International observers say it was Russian missiles fired on those health facilities. At least 50 have died in the attacks, and thousands of people in the region have been left without any medical facility to treat their sick and wounded. And Lyme disease has impacted many tens of thousands who've been infected, many of whom go on to develop lifelong symptoms with very few available treatments. Researchers at the Mayo Clinic have uncovered a new agent responsible for Lyme disease. Borrelia mayoni is a strain discovered in patients in Minnesota and Wyoming. Symptoms differ slightly from the primary Lyme strain first identified in Lyme, Connecticut some decades ago. Currently, antibiotic use soon after infection is the only known way to stop the advance of the disease. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Joe Randolph, President and CEO of the Innovation Institute, a unique collaboration of nonprofit health systems representing over 100,000 healthcare professionals from across the country, dedicated to accelerating development of technologies to improve healthcare delivery. Prior to launching the Institute, Mr. Randolph served as Executive Vice President, Chief Operating Officer, and Chief Financial Officer for St. Joseph Health System, a $5 billion, 16-hospital, multi-state healthcare system. He earned his MBA at Pepperdine University. Joe, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Appreciate being on the show.
Oh, that's great. I think the saying is, may we live in interesting times. I think that's always something that's applicable to the healthcare industry and no more than present as we go through this real change of in this phase of innovation. And there are thousands of entrepreneurs working to launch either new products or develop the new platform that will have a positive impact in the healthcare system. And, you know, we've been fortunate to talk with a lot of innovators and entrepreneurs. We've had Dr. Eric Topol and Esther Dyson, and just recently we had Anish Chopra really discussing their approaches to launching ventures in the health industry in the areas of innovation. Could you tell our listeners about the Innovation Institute? And congratulations, Harvard Business School recently lauded you as a groundbreaking model to watch. What sets your institute apart?
Well, I think a few things. First of all, thanks for the comments. But we launched about 3 years ago. We're a for-profit limited liability company. We're authorized to have 7 what we call member owners or investors as health systems. The difference, I think, one of the big differences in our model is that it's self-sustaining. And so as you all probably have heard and well know, innovation oftentimes from concept to when it gets to market can be several years. And so we wanted to set up a model that would be profitable and self-sustaining from the get-go. So the model that we have is somewhat unique. It's set up to be a collaborative, and the governance structure that we have is set up to be very nimble so that we could take advantage of market opportunities.
Well, Joe, so often some of the best innovations come from those within the care delivery system. I'm betting you saw some of those at St. Joseph's during your time there, from clinicians and other people who work on the front lines in healthcare, people who see the opportunity for improvement, for innovation at that critical intersection between providers and caregivers and patients, as well as maybe between patients and the payer system. But you make the point that clinicians and the organizations they work for and other healthcare workers often have neither the resources nor the time and maybe not the training to fully develop their ideas. So talk with us about how your innovation lab offers a different kind of support to the partners that you're affiliated with, who some of those partners are, and how your system helps bridge that resource gap from a very bright idea to a viable marketplace innovation.
Sure. And as you said, there's differences in terms of how people, you know, look at innovation. And one of the things that I found early on is the definition of innovation varies from organization to organization. And our model is basically a problem-based model to where we tap into the physicians, clinicians, employees that are on the front lines to get their ideas and solutions to problems that they're dealing with and have been dealing with for years. And especially in the nonprofit space, most organizations don't have the ability or the resources to assist physicians with taking their ideas to market. And so what we've put together is we have on staff PhDs, MDs, MBAs that do the initial evaluation and intake of the ideas. We work with the inventor. They get a pretty significant reward for things that are able to go to market. There's no cost to the inventor or to the health system for us evaluating the ideas. We basically, the health systems are owners, and we, on our nickel, incubate the concepts all the way from idea to commercialization. And we also have, as you said, alliances with, you know, like Cleveland Clinic. And so while we have expertise on staff, the amount of subject matter experts that we would need to have to evaluate all the possible ideas that could come in from healthcare would require us to have staffs of, you know, hundreds. And so what we do is we have a strategic alliance agreement with Cleveland Clinic, and we can tap into their research arm and also into their peer physician review groups that have subject matter expertise to help do a deeper evaluation of the concepts. In addition to that relationship, we have industry partners like such as Boston Scientific and Dell and Deloitte. And their interest lies in that they want to be able to tap into our portfolio of ideas and co-develop things with us. Or conversely, if they have something that they want to take to market and they want to partner with someone, they can bring that to us, and we can bring together physicians from across the country to work with them.
You know, Joe, so many of the world's great innovators celebrate the notion of failing forward, a phrase your organization embraces. And yet, while failure is critical to innovation, it can be catastrophic in the healthcare arena. Could you talk about the importance of being able to incubate ideas within a system that allows failure to be part of the path to success? And how does your innovation lab function with failing forward in mind?
I love that the concept, and as you said, we've embraced it. Within healthcare, hospitals and health systems, they tend to be very risk-averse environments. I mean, they focus on things like Lean, Six Sigma, evidence-based medicine, and standardization, and it's all for good reason. But when you think about innovation and the culture of innovation, you really need to be able to reward failure and take risk in order to actually ultimately pivot and break through and find the solution. And Edison was the one that said, I didn't fail 10,000 times. I found 10,000 ways not to make the light bulb. And I love that that comment because I think it's really appropriate. So, you know, we have an environment that's very safe for the inventors to bring their ideas. A lot of times they'll bring a problem that they're looking for a solution for. We'll do the review of prior art and find that there's already a solution out there. And the physicians are just as pleased to find that there's a solution to the problem that they're trying to solve than it is that they're taking their idea to market. So, as I said, having a problems-based model and having physicians that are, you know, scientists at heart, is it's very rewarding to help them take their ideas to market.
Well, Joe, certainly since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, we've seen a dramatic shift toward the notion of value-based care. I don't think there's anybody in healthcare who's not aware of that at this point. And this quest for the triple aim of safer care and better quality, better outcomes, lower cost, and we always add the quadruple one in primary care of more satisfied providers, means that the healthcare industry, $3 trillion a year industry, probably has to recalibrate how it generates the capital to keep running efficiently while also containing costs and improving outcomes. Maybe you could talk with us a little bit about why your approach to innovation is so vitally important at this juncture in health industry reform, in one way for creating viable new revenue streams for health systems to thrive in this future of more value-based care.
Well, I think in the next 20 years, there's going to be more advances in healthcare than there's been in the last 200. So the change that's coming is not incremental. It's going to be exponential. And I think we've not set up our healthcare system to really facilitate innovation. And so having a vehicle like ours that can be a collaborative to bring organizations together to focus on it, I thought was something that was very much needed. I think we got a little bit ahead of the curve, and I think we're in the right spot at the right time. Finding solutions from within healthcare, using the providers and the expertise of the people that are dealing with those problems, I think is much better than having it legislated or come from the outside. And I think, you know, there's a very great acceptance for the model that we've put forth, and the providers that we're working with, I think, are very pleased with our approach.
We're speaking today with Joe Randolph, President and CEO of the Innovation Institute, dedicated to accelerating development of new technologies to improve healthcare delivery. Prior to launching the Institute, Mr. Randolph served as Executive Vice President, Chief Operating Officer, and CFO for St. Joseph's Health System, a $5 billion, 16-hospital, multi-state healthcare system. Joe, you know, we also are engaged in research. We have our own institute, the Weizmann Institute, and, you know, have grabbed on to some of the traditional techniques that you've talked about, you know, Lean and Six Sigma, and certainly Dartmouth's clinical microsystem. And really with this focus of frontline staff making the decisions, but having a support team in place. But you've said that these are necessary steps to yield some small incremental changes by standardizing processes, but that truly disruptive innovation requires more out-of-the-box as well as in-the-box thinking. Maybe you could illuminate for our listeners what you've learned from applying those types of systems while at the helm of a large health organization, and what more can be achieved from incubating ideas outside the organization and where you can afford to be less risk-averse.
Actually, great question. And part of the impetus for us forming the Innovation Institute was, you know, I oftentimes in my previous roles had physicians or clinicians come to me with what I thought were great ideas, and because of compliance issues or because the physician was a big admitter at the hospital, there was, you know, legal issues with us investing in his idea or concept. And so I've always wanted to have a vehicle to where we could help these physicians, you know, and not just the physicians, but clinicians and employees take their ideas to market. And so I think creating an environment that's safe to where they can bring their ideas. I mean, it's almost like the physicians and the people that come to us, it feels like they're in a toy store because they're so excited about it. And, you know, there's a book called The Alchemy of Growth that talks about the different phases of organizations. And I think healthcare, as organizations grow and they get larger, they get very conservative and very risk averse. And it's also at a time when, you know, with the Accountable Care Act and budgets getting tighter, It's difficult for organizations to embed, you know, innovation within, you know, as a department of their health system, because they look at a very short horizon in terms of the returns. And as you know, I mean, from concept, like on a medical device, it could take 5 to 7 years before that device gets to the point to where it's cash flowing. And so what we tried to create with our unique business model, and we have, I don't mean to get into a lot of detail, but we have a portfolio of service companies that we provide to industry, and the profits from that then get reinvested into innovation. It allows us to take a longer-term view on things and not worry about the short-term risk of the investment. And so I think, you know, the model, you know, healthcare with using Lean and Six Sigma, I think it works really well in terms of the incremental reductions, the standardization, patient safety, and elimination of errors, but it doesn't work well when you're thinking about innovation where you need to take risk.
Well, Joe, it certainly is palpable that collaboration and partnership are just central to your DNA, probably the DNA of the Innovation Institute. And I thought you've made the interesting point that many innovation enterprises are internally led, such as at Kaiser Permanente and the Mayo Clinic, and specific to their own bottom line, which is a little different than replicating these innovations in the broader marketplace. So be interested in maybe hearing about your take on the inherent strengths and challenges in your model of collaboration with multiple entities. How have some of the partnerships that you've formed, say with the Cleveland Clinic or other research institutions, enhanced this innovation process for you?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the problems that we're dealing with are, you know, consistent across organizations. And so having the ability to tap into multiple organizations to look for solutions, I think you're going to come up with better ideas the more minds you have working on the same problem. And that was some of the philosophy that went into the model, was that if we can set this up to be truly a collaborative, we can come up with better solutions. And one of the processes that we've set up that we're going to be using is called facilitated innovation, where we'll take a specific problem state, bring together subject matter experts from across these different systems as well as Cleveland Clinic, and spend a, you know, 3 days focused session on working through looking for commercialization opportunities and solutions to these problems.
You know, Joe, I was looking at a stat that said over half of the entrepreneur startups fail to make it. I was thinking that's probably they're doing better than the folks who run restaurants, who about 90% of them fail after 5 years. But we often sort of lament the amount of time it takes to get from the bench to the bedside, particularly with drugs, sort of on average up to 17 years. And yet we may be at an important inflection point where technology and big data and analytics and other forces can change the pace of success. And, you know, what kind of breakthroughs are you envisioning will emerge from your research approach? I sort of like that. I don't know if it was a Kaizen you were doing for 3 days, but really getting focused in. So tell us where you see the greatest potential for growth right now.
I mean, I think the future is so exciting. And I'm not a scientist. My background is finance, so everything is a shiny object to me. But when I get with the scientists and the physicians, a lot of times, you know, the experts, they'll tell me that no, it's not that great of an idea. But I think that, you know, genomics is and personalized medicine is going to be a huge area of opportunity. I think brain research, there's so little really known about the brain. And I just read this morning about some work at UCI where, you know, they were setting up algorithms that could help somebody that's paralyzed walk. And, you know, tissue regeneration, big data, artificial intelligence, all areas that I think have tremendous potential and opportunities. Again, we're not going to, no one group is going to come up with all the answers, but I think the more that we can bring industry and providers and clinicians together, I think the better chance we have of having some huge breakthroughs.
Well, Joe, we've certainly seen that excitement within our own research institute, as Mark noted, and just how powerfully and compellingly exciting it is for people in healthcare to make a positive contribution beyond day-to-day care, but something that really changes the system. So I guess we'd like to ask you, before we wrap up, would you like to share with us a couple of the things that you've seen the Innovation Institute receive as bright ideas and move along or be well along the road to becoming a sustainable part of the healthcare system?
Well, I mean, you know, there's several things. I mean, it's part of the biggest part of the my enjoyment from my job. It comes from meeting with these inventors. They're so passionate about, you know, finding these solutions and
right.
seeing them come to fruition.
Yep.
There's a medical, somebody that was an Olympic hopeful soccer player that had an ankle injury, never was able to get the right kind of treatment, never was able to fulfill his dream. He became a physical therapist at one of the hospitals that we work with, developed this ankle therapy device that we have patents on, and it's going to market. I think it's probably one of the best devices for ankle you know, injuries that I've seen in terms of the treatment. And so that one is one that I'm looking forward to seeing how it plays out. There's another one that a surgeon came up with that, and sometimes, you know, it's not the pharma or the big, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. scientific breakthroughs. It's just a simple solution that somebody's been dealing with mm-hmm. for their career that could make a big difference. And this one is for needles to, you know, they have sharps containers in the patient rooms to get rid of the needles when they give patients shots, but in the OR they set them on the tray, and oftentimes, you know, a physician or a nurse will reach and get a needle stick, and this is something that can park the syringes and change the needles and count the sutures. It's a device that sits right on the tray, and so that's another one that we're excited about. So those are just a couple, but there's several more. I could go on for probably a half hour to talk about some of the things.
We've been speaking today with Joe Randolph, President and CEO of the Innovation Institute, dedicated to accelerating development of innovation technologies aimed at improving healthcare delivery. You can learn more about their work by going to IIchange.com or follow them on Twitter at II4Change. Joe, thanks so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In one of the Democratic presidential debates, Hillary Clinton said that the Affordable Care Act had helped more African Americans than any other group to get insurance. But the Obama administration's own figures show a larger drop in the uninsured among Latinos. The Department of Health and Human Services released an analysis in late September 2015 saying 17.6 million people had gained health insurance coverage under the ACA. The administration said that figure included three groups: young adults who were able to stay on their parents' policies until age 26, those who signed up for the Medicaid expansion, and those who gained coverage through the state and federal insurance marketplaces. The rate of uninsured African American adults dropped by 10.3 percentage points, a greater decline than among whites, but not as much as the rate dropped for Latinos. Between October 2013 and September 12, 2015, 4 million Latino adults gained coverage, a drop in the rate of uninsured of 11.5 percentage points. For African Americans, 2.6 million people gained coverage, a 10.3 percentage point drop in the uninsured, and for white adults, 7.4 million gained insurance, a 6 percentage point drop in the uninsured. A December 2014 Urban Institute report projected the ACA could, quote, substantially narrow differences in uninsurance rates between whites and all racial ethnic minorities except blacks. Why? Because blacks disproportionately live in states that did not expand Medicaid. Overall, a larger percentage of the Latino population is still uninsured, 30.3%. Among African Americans, 12.1% are uninsured, and among white Americans, 8.3% are uninsured. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Clubfoot is one of the most common childhood deformities in the world, a condition that in the past was not correctable without the intervention of expensive and invasive surgeries. In low-resource parts of the world, access was nearly impossible, and as a result, clubfoot is the leading cause of disability in the developing world.
The effects on the child are devastating. It also has an incredible impact on the mom. These kids have to be taken care of because they're disabled, and often the mother is blamed for having a child with any kind of a problem as well as having a child with a disability. So devastating for the whole family.
But a breakthrough treatment called the Ponseti method has changed all of that. Cheska Colorado Mansfield was an employee at the University of Iowa where this new, non-invasive, inexpensive intervention was developed, which corrected the problem in a series of months, often before a child even begins to walk.
The healthcare provider gently manipulates the tendons and ligaments in the foot and moves the foot about 10 to 15 degrees and then places the feet in a long leg plaster of Paris cast. That cast stays on for 1 week, and then they repeat the process, and they just gradually move the feet.
She and her colleagues founded Miracle Feet, a nonprofit organization that identifies children throughout the world born with club feet, who can be treated for about $250 per child, a tiny fraction of what the surgery would cost, and just as effective in treatment of the condition. Today, Miracle Feet supports over 100 clinics through partnerships with 25 different partners in 12 different countries, already having given thousands of children in the developing world the chance to walk, run, play, and to grow into productive adults. Miracle Feet has earned numerous awards for its innovative treatment design and its ability to be easily deployed in low-resource settings.
They have to sleep in a brace at night. The one that we've made, the one that's winning the awards, is made out of plastic. We came up with a brace that the shoes clip on and off, it's adjustable, the angles are fixed, so there's no problem with the medical efficacy of it, and we can produce it for $20. So we've essentially come up with a design that enables us to do everything the U.S. brace does, but for a fraction of the cost.
Miracle Feet, providing a low-cost treatment for children born with club foot around the world, giving them a chance to live active and fully productive lives. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.